Right. Well, it now gives me great pleasure to introduce Vint Cerf. And I'm sure it's a bit superfluous me actually providing an introduction for Vint. He's so well known within this industry environment that we are working in. His background in the internet is certainly well recognised. Vint Cerf is Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist for Google. In this role, he is responsible for identifying new enabling technologies to support the development of advanced internet-based products and services from Google. Widely known as one of the fathers of the internet, I'm sure that's where we all recognize him from, Vint is the co-designer of the TCP/IP protocols and an key architecture of the internet. And he's just going to also provide his skills in terms of sticking microphones onto desks.
Right,
thank you, Stephen.
It's the theory that duct tape solves all problems, right? Okay.
He is the former chairman of the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICANN, and is an honorary chairman of the IPv6 Forum. He's dedicated to raising the awareness and speeding the introduction of IPv6, and of course, that's the subject that we're keen to hear from him today. So thank you very much indeed, Vint. Great to have you along.
Thanks so much.
And welcome to the podium.
Oh, good morning, everyone. This is New Zealand, so I'm supposed to start out with tēnā koutou katoa. And that's all the Maori I know how to say. I'm really delighted to be here for a number of different reasons, not the least of which is that later on in the weekend I intend to suck down some really good Pinot Noir and Sauvignon Blanc when we get to Martinborough. So I can be easily attracted to events like this when I have the opportunity to sample some good wines. Let me start out by taking you back into history. 40 years ago, this is what the nascent internet looked like. It was the predecessor called the ARPANET. It only had four nodes on it. They were essentially packet switches, and the technology of packet switching at the time was considered highly controversial. The conventional wisdom of the time was that circuit switching was the only way to do telecommunications. That was how the telephone system worked, and after all, they'd had 100-some-odd years to demonstrate that. So the then telephone company in the United States, AT&T, declined to participate in this experiment except to offer lease lines to link the various packet switches together. I was a graduate student at UCLA at the time and wrote the software to connect a particular computer called a Sigma 7 to the first node of the ARPANET. The computer's in a museum like the one that we're in right now, and some people think I should be there, you know, along with the computer, but here I am. When you fast forward a few more years, you see the first demonstration of the new TCP/IP protocols that Bob Kahn and I developed starting in 1973. We linked three different kinds of packet switch nets together: a mobile radio network operating in the San Francisco Bay Area, a packet satellite net operating using the synchronous Intelsat 4 satellite over the Atlantic, linking the west coast of Europe and the east coast of the United States, and the ARPANET, which by that time had extended all the way across to some countries in Europe, using an internal satellite hop that was invisible except for the delay. It was simply part of the ARPANET system. But these three networks independently were linked using TCP/IP protocols and things that we called gateways at the time because we didn't know they were supposed to be called routers. This was a successful demonstration, and it was significant because it was the first time we'd gotten all three of the networks to interact together. The next 20 years goes by, and we see an internet that looks like this. This is an image that was automatically generated by looking at the BGP routing tables and displaying the autonomous systems in different colors. What you get out of this picture, of course, is the net got bigger and it got more connected and it got more colorful. It also demonstrates the fact that the internet is not a top-down structure. It is a collaborative activity. The networks, which number in the hundreds of thousands, are independently operated. And the only reason this system works is that they all adopt the same set of protocols voluntarily, and they choose to interconnect in many cases for business reasons, to each other and to pass traffic back and forth. And that's the nature of internet. It's a very open environment. It's one that has evolved and changed in terms of speeds, in terms of types of packet switching networks and technologies and new applications over time, and that's still true today in 2009. If you look at some of the statistics, you see over 600 million machines are visible in the public internet. These are machines with fixed IP addresses and domain names, so they're typically servers. This doesn't include things that are episodically connected, like laptops or PDAs and things of that kind. So there are actually a much larger number of machines than this number would indicate. Moreover, firewalls and other kinds of mechanisms are hiding a great deal of the computing power of the internet, because corporations create a sort of virtual private networking enclaves, the computing resources of which are not directly visible to the public. Google is a good example of that. We have a very large-scale collection of data centers all around the world with a classified number of computers in them, and those are not directly visible to you. Now, the ones you see are the ones that interface to the public internet, but the interior network and its assets are not directly visible. There are estimated to be 1.6 billion users on the internet as of March, and the number is certainly bigger now in August. And in the same general development period, mobiles have become an important part of the telecommunications environment. Everyone carries one, sometimes two, or even more. About 15% of them are internet-enabled today, and of course that percentage will go up over time, and it's the presence of such a large number of devices like that which in part motivates the need for a larger address space. If you look at where the users are, you see this sort of distribution as of March. The numbers probably haven't changed too much percentage-wise. One thing did surprise me. I was in Beijing before I came here, and the 660 million Asian users, of the 660 million, the Chinese represent 338 million. So they're nearly half, over a little over half of the Asian population is Chinese. The Chinese internet penetration is about 22% of their population, so you can imagine what this is going to be like when the penetration rate reaches 75%, which is where it is in North America today on average. It will be over a billion Chinese users. The point about this chart is partly to illustrate that the applications and content and use of the internet is going to shift depending on its user base. The languages that are present on the net will shift as well. And so we will see an internet which is colored increasingly by a more diverse population than ever. In places where it's still limited in penetration, like Africa, even there we will see significant increases, partly from the use of mobiles and partly from the presence of new technologies. There recently are fiber terminations in Africa that are increasing access, and there are satellite programs underway, like the O3B, other 3 billion satellite program, which will bring broadband access to parts of Africa, Central Latin America, and the Pacific Islands, where terminations haven't been readily available at high speed. So all that will increase the total internet population and drive demand for IP address space. The number of devices on the internet will exceed the number of people. This is easily predicted today. Some of the devices have surprised me, like picture frames and refrigerators and telephones that look like telephones, but in this case they're actually Cisco voice over IP devices. But the one I found the most amusing is an internet-enabled surfboard. There's a guy in the Netherlands, apparently he was out surfing, and I guess he was waiting for the next wave and got bored and said, you know, if I had a laptop and my surfboard, I could be surfing the internet while I'm waiting to get the next wave. So he built a laptop into his surfboard, and he put a Wi-Fi server back in the rescue shack, and now he sells this as a product. In case you happen to want to replicate that here, I'm sure there's some pretty good surfing in both senses of the word in New Zealand. So one of the things which I'm seeing happen is the increase in sensor networks showing up as part of the internet environment. We'll see these for a variety of different reasons. I have a sensor net in my house. It's running IPv6 over 6 LoWPAN, 802.15.4. and is used to capture temperature, humidity, and light levels in 12 rooms in the house, including the wine cellar. That information is captured every 5 minutes. It's stored on a server, and at the end of a year, I have a very good profile of how well my heating, ventilation, and air conditioning system have actually served the household. And there's a, I'm an engineer, and I want real data. I don't want anecdotal reports that this room seemed hot in the summer or cold in the winter. So when it comes to the end of the year, I can really do some serious engineering to shift the baffles around and change the way the cooling and heating are distributed. But there's also a very important room in this collection. It's the wine cellar, and it needs to be kept at 60 degrees Fahrenheit or less. And so that particular room is warmed. If the temperature goes up above 60 degrees, I get an SMS on my mobile saying your wine is warming up. This has happened twice now. In the last event where the cooling system failed, it was just 2 days ago. And I got a little SMS saying the temperature in the wine cellar is now 65 degrees and counting. So I emailed my wife and said, would you please go reset the cooling system, which she did. And then the next report that came back said the wine is coming back down. It's now at 59 degrees at 6 a.m. East Coast, U.S. East Coast time. So I'm now happy camper again. I have to admit, though, as I looked at the potential for sensor systems and how they can change the way our lives work, first, we need larger numbers of addresses in the Internet to accommodate all these devices. And second, I thought, well, let's see, I have light levels that I can detect. So if somebody goes into the wine cellar when I'm not there, I can tell that somebody went in because the light went on. Of course, I can't tell whether they took anything out. And so I thought, well, the next idea would be to put RFID chips on each bottle. And I can do instantaneous inventory to see whether any bottles have left the wine cellar without my permission. Someone pointed out to me, though, that you could go into the wine cellar and drink the wine and leave the bottle. You know, so I clearly need to extend this thing, you know, put sensors in the cork and, you know, detect whether there's anything left in the bottle. And as long as you're going to do that, you might as well go to the trouble of analyzing the esters that make wine taste good and figure out whether the wine is ready to drink. Then when you're, you know, before you open a bottle, you interrogate the cork to find out what the state of the wine is. And if this is one of the bottles that got to, you know, 85 degrees because of the cooling failure, that's the bottle you give to somebody who doesn't know the difference. So there are lots of utilities hiding in here. The thing which is even more motivating, though, with regard to sensors is the trend towards the notion of smart grid. It goes by various names. In the United States, there's a major initiative underway to instrument appliances and devices that consume electricity. For two reasons. One, to report their consumption so that you can have some idea at the end of the month when you get an electric bill, why is your electric bill what it is? You know, how did you consume that power? And second, these devices theoretically could also accept guidance, as in, why don't you shut down right now during this peak load? It's not going to make a big difference if your air conditioner is not running for the next 5 minutes or 10 minutes or something, or the water heater is not running for a little while. But if you can clip peak loads, you do all kinds of useful things. You reduce the requirement for capital to build peak load requirements that are only used for 2% of the time. You also reduce the amount of pollution dumped into the atmosphere. So I see a number of different motivations for having sensor networks and other kinds of Internet-enabled appliances in our Internet universe, entertainment systems that will accept remote control. Just by way of example, I'm a Verizon Fios subscriber, and from my laptop, I can actually go to the entertainment systems in my house and see all the programs that have been recorded on the DVR. I can start recording things remotely, I can erase things remotely. Basically, I can control the entertainment system in the house through the Internet. I foresee an increasing interest in being able to manage systems this way, or even to allocate to a third party responsibility for organizing entertainment, for example. So by Internet enabling these things, you create a lot of business opportunities that otherwise wouldn't exist. This diagram will be familiar to almost all of you. It's taken from Jeff Houston's web pages. Showing the important part, of course, is the line that's going down. This is not the current view of the stock market. It's actually the amount of IPv4 address space that remains to be allocated by IANA, the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority. you'll see some more charts like this from Tony Haynes, who speaks after me with much more detail about the nature of the runout. The fact that we're running out of IP addresses is partly my fault, because in 1977 I was faced with the question, how big should the address space be of the Internet? And there were there was about a year's worth of debate on this subject. One group wanted variable length addresses, but the programmers said that sucked because you had to waste computer cycles to find the fields of the packets, so they didn't want to do that, so that went away. And then it was up to either 32 bits or 128. Now, it's 1977, and this is an experiment that we don't know for sure is going to work. And I'm sitting here thinking, 128 bits, 340 trillion, trillion, trillion addresses to do an experiment? That doesn't pass the red face test. And so I said, oh, look, 32 bits is enough to do an experiment, and then if it works, you know, we'll do a production version. Well, that's fine, except the experiment didn't end, and here we are 30 years later, and we need more address space. So IPv6 is the answer to that. Here you have a clear sense, I think, of how little IPv4 address space is left to be allocated by IANA to the regional internet registries, 28/8s, which isn't much at the rate at which IP addresses are being consumed. The V6 address space really is quite large. It's broken up right now into 264-bit pieces. Tony will give you some more details, and you will probably all know most of it anyway. The thing that I want to point out is that it really is important for us to implement IPv6 in parallel with IPv4. We speak about replacement, but the honest truth is that for a while we're going to wind up running both phone calls in parts of the Internet. Ideally, we would have all gotten IPv6 implemented before the runout of V4. It's not clear that we're going to succeed in that goal, since the runout is imminent. So we're going to wind up with a mixed address space and all the problems associated with that. But IPv6 does have some important characteristics in addition to larger address space. It's not just that. It has other functionality and touches many, many parts of the Internet structure. One of the things that I like about it is that it can go into end-to-end secure mode on demand of one of the two parties that are communicating. The reason that's valuable is not just for confidentiality, but it also inhibits deep packet inspection, which can be used to cause various kinds of, or to exploit various kinds of vulnerabilities that require you to see the address fields or the fields of higher layer protocols. So by running end-to-end encrypted, you actually defend against certain kinds of vulnerabilities. It also doesn't solve certain problems, and it's important that we all understand that. For example, if you have an email with a virus attached to it, and you're using IPsec, the email along with the virus get encrypted. And it goes through this cast iron pipe through the net. It gets decrypted at the other end, delivered, you know, with full integrity to cause trouble on the other side. So the end-to-end crypto does not solve all the vulnerability problems, but it does, in fact, solve some of them. There's a flow ID concept inside of IPv6, which, to my knowledge, has not been exploited much. I hope we get to do some experiments with that, but to do that, we have to have more IPv6 implemented so we can try things out. I'm proud to say that Google has been pursuing the implementation of IPv6 almost 2 years now. A big push came in January of 2008 when we convened a meeting of about, 90 or 100 people, including some folks from outside. Tony Haynes was there from Cisco. Others were there from Juniper and other vendors. And we looked at the feasibility of implementing IPv6 for all of Google's services. And at that point, we started demonstrating ipv6.google.com, so that if you wanted to see whether you could get to Google by way of IPv6, you could try to go to that domain name. We didn't try to IPv6 enable www.google.com at the outset, and the reason for that was that IPv6 is not uniformly implemented and connected everywhere in the Internet today. It shows up in different islands, and just because you happen to implement IPv6 doesn't mean that you could connect to everyone else who's also implemented it. That's actually a serious problem, and it's an area where we really have to do something. We have to establish policies that will lead to IPv6 connectivity throughout the Internet. That may mean liberalizing peering policies, at least in the short term, in order to assure that anyone who's running V6 can reach anyone else who is, because today that's not the case. You can use tunneling methods, and you'll hear more about those, but I find tunneling to be brittle and potentially difficult to debug when things are not working properly. I'd much rather see a fully connected IPv6 network, and so I'm a proponent of that. I've already talked about this rapid exhaustion, and Tony and I both agree that it's very likely that we will see a very tumultuous denouement of the allocation of the IPv4 address space as people realize that the real runout is going to happen. It's been amazing how many ISPs, for example, have simply decided they are denying that we're going to run out, but you can see the allocations every single month. You'll see some examples of that from Tony. So we may see auctions and gray markets and black markets, people trying to sell access to the internet to address space, the V4 address space, which will fragment the routing tables and cause the routing tables to get bigger and potentially cause some address space to no longer be routable, in which case people will disappear off of the connected internet. Some people will hijack V4 addresses, especially the allocations, legacy allocations, that were done before the existence of the regional internet registries. I'm not a big fan of NAT. I understand that network address translation has been helpful in cases where you have a small amount of IPv4 address space and you want to monetize it by allowing a large number of devices to be connected to that one IP address. But it creates a variety of brittle and fragile characteristics, and it doesn't work terribly well for peer-to-peer applications. There's also an argument that some people will make that, well, I don't really need to worry about this run out. I have enough IPv4 address space, so the rest of the world can worry about it. I'm happy. The problem is that if your customers need to communicate with people who have only IPv6 addresses and you're only running IPv4, you either are going to run into a real mess trying to do translations back and forth, which may or may not work. Or you need to have IPv6 capability to deliver to your customers who need to communicate to the rest of the world. And so just because you aren't running out doesn't mean you're safe. It's the rest of the world that's running out that creates the problem for you. And if you don't understand that, you really need to go back and think about it, because connectivity is what makes the internet useful. And if you can't get end-to-end connectivity, you don't have a product, you don't have a service. I've already talked a lot about the sensor networks, so I just want to reemphasize that devices are going to drive a lot of the demand for IP address space in the future. This is not a trivial task to implement. Google has spent, as I said, the last couple of years doing the work. On the other hand, it hasn't taken an army of people either. A lot of the software is already present in the routers. A lot of it's already available in the end devices, laptops, desktops, servers. Getting everything to work uniformly and finding all the places in the software where an assumption is made that an IP address is 32 bits does take a fair amount of work. It's kind of like the Y2K problem, where people had to find the places where the year was represented with two digits because 19 was assumed. And so that's taken us a fair amount of time, but it hasn't required a huge number of people. It's just taken some smart people. And you'll find, prefacing Tony's remarks, that training is going to count for a lot of the success in getting IPv6 implemented. I worry a lot, of course, about the fact that we have to run V4 and V6 concurrently. That means we have routing tables for both protocols, routing protocols for both address formats, which means increasing table sizes. The other thing, which is not 100% apparent, is that the network management mechanisms in the various vendor software suites may or may not be fully IPv6 enabled. Some vendors may still be relying on IPv4 for management, even though they may be running both V4 and V6 routing. And here I think it's important to get to the point where everything could be run purely with IPv6 if necessary. We talked about the fragmented connectivity problem and peering. I also have been somewhat worried about the way in which the V6 address space has been allocated, because fairly large chunks of it are being delivered by the RIRs. A /48 is a very big number of bits. although the way things have been cut up, 64 bits in the lower half are being used for local subnet or local host identification, which takes a fairly whopping big piece of 128-bit address space and allocates it off to that function. It's been a little worrying for me because I'm afraid that we might, let me use a technical term, piss away the huge address space that we were trying to make last for a long time. Now, I only care that it lasts until after I'm dead, you know, and then it's somebody else's problem. But I would like very much to have it, this address space last longer than the IPv4 address space did. And finally, there's some business model issues here. Occasionally, I would hear ISPs saying, well, you know, why, it's going to cost me money to implement this stuff. How am I going to make money on IPv6? Can I charge extra for that? And my reaction to this is sometimes not printable, but usually my reaction is, let me get this straight. You're in the internet business, right?
Yes.
And the way you supply service to these people is you supply them with IP addresses so they can be part of the internet. Yes. Do you think it's important for you to continue to have address space available to supply it to your customers? Yes. Said, well, you look at this curve over here. Yes. It's going to run out in 2010. Maybe you should think about your business model as the years and months go by. If you don't have any address space to allocate, how in the hell are you going to have a business? Well, that's, you know, a year from now, and I'm only worried about the next quarter. Well, sorry, that's really bad planning. The worst thing in the world is to engineer stuff in a crisis. And it takes some time, just as we've experienced at Google, to do a thorough job of implementing IPv6. So the time to do it is now, not a year from now, not when you're in the crisis, not when you've run out. And if you think that multiple-level NATs will solve your problem, listen to Tony. Now, I have a whole bunch of dialogue stuff here, which I'm actually not going to wade through. It's in my slides because the slides are going to be available to you, and I want you to read this stuff. This is a dialogue with people at Google who have been implementing IPv6, and the questions are from people who wonder, you know, what was that like, and what are the issues, and how do you justify the work? So I'm just going to show you the questions, which I hope will stimulate some discussion among yourselves, and I'm going to skip over a lot of the answers here, so I'm sorry you're just not reading that. This is a big question. Why are people going to adopt IPv6? Some people are saying, well, I don't care, my customers are not asking for it, and until they ask for it, I'm not going to bother. This gets back to the, you know, can't see, you know, more than 2 inches in front of your face. I think it's true, though. Some ISPs are just going to wait. They're going to say, hey, I don't have a problem, and then they'll wake up and say, you know, several bad words. My belief is that there will be some driving forces coming from devices that are IPv6 only. While I was in Beijing, I had the opportunity to see quite an array of devices that are IPv6 only. Talking to Jun Murai in Japan at Keio University, I saw a wide range of things that have been developed that are IPv6 only. Those are going to be in the marketplace, and you will be faced with dealing with them. And so you can't ignore that, I don't think. That may be part of the driver. I'm going to skip over that. Do you think that it will be the end users or the content providers that adopt IPv6 first? This has always been something of a conundrum. And my first thought is that certainly the content providers, if they don't supply things in v6, will leave the users with little motivation to implement IPv6. So that's what led Google to implement v6 for all of its services, which we're almost done with now. On the other hand, the end users may show up driving v6 by buying appliances and devices that are v6 enabled, and they'll say, well, this thing doesn't work without v6 service, and they'll be knocking on the doors of the ISPs saying, how come my stuff doesn't work? So I think there's going to be pressure from several directions to get this stuff done. Who do you think the transition will affect the most, the ISPs, consumers, or content providers? And the honest answer is that everybody gets affected, but in theory, the consumer shouldn't see anything. If we do our jobs well, they'll just see URLs. The URLs will get translated into V4 or V6, whatever is needed. The ISPs, on the other hand, absolutely have to implement both protocols. They have to be connected. They have to run the network management, everything else. They're probably the ones that are the most affected. From the Google point of view, as a content provider, we still had a lot of work to do to make sure that we could interface to a public network that was running both protocols, so everybody gets touched by this. But I hope the users don't see much of it at all. Do you think the private sector will be able to complete the transition on their own, or will it take massive governmental or organizational movement? Well, I don't think it takes massive governmental movement, but governments can show leadership. They can demand, for example, that when they buy internet service, that it comes with both V4 and V6 capability. They can create incentives for implementing both protocols. They might even consider making it mandating certain things to happen by certain times. Although my general experience with government mandating things is that it frequently doesn't work, especially if people don't want to do it. This is the essence of leadership: is you can't lead people to where they don't want to go. So we have to create a real rationale for why people should go there. And when you hear Tony's pitch, if you don't walk out of this room believing that IPv6 is tomorrow morning's first task, you ain't listening. Okay, let me skip over this part. I just wanted to draw your attention to other things besides IPv6 that are happening in the internet universe, because this year, 2009, is probably the biggest year of change that I have seen in the last 30 years of working on internet. One of them is putting in digital signatures in the domain name system in order to preserve or at least verify the integrity of the binding between a domain name and an IP address. There's a lot of opportunity for hijacking, cache poisoning, and the like, and those can be defended against by having digitally signed domain names. And so we're seeing top-level domain operators around the world implementing this. The root zone should be signed sometime this year in order to provide a solid trust anchor for the remaining hierarchical digital signature system. The second thing is that internationalized domain names are under continuing development. There was a 2003 implementation specification for internationalized domain names, so we have 5 or 6 years of experience with that particular spec. There were problems associated with it. A very, very large number of the Unicode code points were allowed in internationalized domain names, and it led to a lot of potential confusion, misrouting, things of that sort, where phishing and farming attacks were enabled. There's a new version of IDN spec. It's called IDN 2008. We are in the working group last call phase of that spec, literally as we speak, which should end sometime around August 31st, and then it will go up to the Internet Engineering Steering Group for final IETF last call. So the reason that I bring this up, though, is that it still creates opportunities for phishing. And I wish that there were a simple set of rules that would prevent the symbols of different languages from looking like each other, but sorry, we don't have any control over language. And to say, well, we're going to exclude a whole bunch of character sets just because they look like other character sets is not a feasible thing. There's a penetration of the internet, as you saw from the other numbers, in a large part of the world where the languages are not expressible in Latin characters. And so people who speak Arabic or Chinese or Russian who need Cyrillic or Hebrew all need these character sets. We have to put them in, because if we don't, they'll put them in anyway and they'll fragment the domain name system, and that's not a good thing for anyone. It's the connectivity of the internet that makes it valuable. So we're going to see new country code top-level domains. India, for example, has 22 official languages, so I don't know how many top-level domains they're going to ask for to represent the notion of India. But there's sure to be Chinua, for example, in Chinese will almost certainly be one proposal. The Russians will ask for something in Cyrillic and so on. So you'll see that happening during 2010, most likely. The other thing which I find interesting is that technologically, things are really changing in some dramatic ways. Moore's Law doesn't work the way it used to. In the past, Moore's Law worked by doubling the clock speed of every chip. That's not working anymore, because in order to double clock speed, you have to increase power consumption, and that increases heat dissipation, and eventually the circuits melt. And so that's not a good scenario. So instead, what's happening is the clock speeds are at a plateau, and the implementer chip implementers are simply adding more cores. So we have more CPUs per chip. This is a big challenge now for anyone who has any software programmer who's been getting a free ride from increasing clock speed. You know, you write a piece of crappy code, and next year it runs twice as fast as it did before. That's all pretty cool, except now that doesn't work. And the only way you get any horsepower out of these new chips is if your code is parallelizable. And sometimes you can parallelize algorithms, and sometimes not so easy. In Google's case, we're lucky because a lot of what we do is in parallel. When each one of you does a search, I can allocate a different core for each search, and you know, by that way parallelize my service and take advantage of all the cores. I do worry a little bit about the I/O bandwidth on and off the chip. If that doesn't increase commensurate with the number of cycles that I can get on the chip, I'm in trouble. So we really have to start thinking a little more carefully about how to take advantage of Moore's Law in this new multi-core architecture. The other thing which I've become very worried about, I'm going to skip down here to save some time, is something that has to do with the amount of data that we're accumulating. The more sensor networks we have, the more documents we generate, the more tools we use that are online, and the more digital stuff we accumulate. And the only way that that digital stuff is useful is if we have applications that still know how to interpret the stuff. So you have all these complex files lying around, things that are interpretable by PowerPoint or by Google Docs or any of the other applications you're running. What happens if the software that you use to interpret those files isn't available anymore or doesn't work anymore? I said, well, how could that be? Well, here's an example. It's the year 3000, and you've just done a Google search. And you can say you're running Windows 3000, and you pick up a 1997 PowerPoint file. So this is a 1,000-year-old artifact, and the question is, does Windows 3000 know how to interpret a 1,000-year-old PowerPoint file? And the answer is probably no. And that's not Microsoft's fault. It's simply hard to maintain backward compatibility over a long period of time for complex file formats. And lest you think that isn't really the case, I want you to think about maybe some of the digital imagery that you have stored away on your disk. I'm already discovering that some of the older formats for JPEG or TIFFs and so on are not always interpretable by all the photographic software programs that are available today. They aren't all backward compatible. So I'm very worried about this bit rot problem where you've accumulated a bunch of digital stuff and suddenly it doesn't get interpreted anymore. There's some really tough intellectual property problems associated with trying to solve this. If you say, well, a company says, I'm not going to support this version of software anymore for good business reasons, and you say, well, can I have a can I keep the source code around? Of course, the answer is no, you can't, because half of that source code went into the new version. It's just not backward compatible. So then you say, well, could I just run it somewhere? And they say, sure. And then you say, but it requires a particular operating system to run. Yes. Well, could I have a copy of the operating system? No. Do I need to have not only the application program, but the operating system, and maybe even an emulator of the hardware that the operating system ran on? Well, we might be able to get this to work in a cloud environment where you emulate things, but there's still going to be arguments over who has control over what software. Figuring out how to solve this problem is not going to be easy, but it's an embarrassment. We see all the benefits of this online digital world and all these wonderful tools and everything else. Then you start worrying about bit rot, and then the librarian comes along with her 1,000-year-old vellum codex and opens it up, and you can read it. It's still beautifully illustrated. The colors are brilliant, and you know, you can look at it and you can read it if you happen to read, you know, Latin or Greek or what have you. And we're faced with not being able to do as well as sheepskin. And that's I know you got a lot of sheep here. You can probably digitize that somehow. But we really do face an embarrassing problem of making our digital stuff accessible over long periods of time. So. IPv6 is not going to solve that problem, by the way. That's a hard one. I have a lot of stuff here about cloud computing, but I'm concerned about time, and I want to make sure that we get to Tony's presentation. So let me just say that today we are faced in the cloud computing world with a problem that the internet faced in 1973. In 1973, there were lots of computer networks available, but they were proprietary. SNA for IBM, DECnet for Digital, DS for HP and others, X25 and so on. But you couldn't interconnect them because there was no way to say to a given network, send this to another net. There was no vocabulary for that. That's why the internet protocol had to be designed and built with an internet address space that was multi-net in scope. Well, in the cloud world, we have a similar situation now. We have clouds at Google, we have clouds at Microsoft, we have clouds at Amazon, we have IBM building enterprise clouds. But within a cloud, you don't have any way of saying, send this to another cloud. So if I'm in cloud A, and I'm a user, and I want my data in cloud A to go to cloud B, maybe for replication, maybe because there's functionality in cloud B that I can't get in cloud A, there's no way to say that. And to make matters worse, when you're in Cloud A, if you have access control on the data that's sitting in Cloud A, how do you move the metadata to Cloud B so that that access control is correctly replicated? And the answer is we don't know how to do that. We have no vocabulary for doing that. We don't know how or what we could ask another cloud to do. We don't know how to convey that information back and forth. And I believe that we are going to want to do that. I think we are going to want to be able to treat clouds as entities in the same way that we treated networks as entities in this network of networks. So actually, there's a lot of work to be done to figure out how to implement a multi-cloud environment. So for people who would like to do what Bob and I and others did 30 years ago, you actually have an opportunity because the inter-cloud problem is an unsolved area for research and development and experimentation. So, the world is still open to some pretty interesting new ideas, cloud computing being one of them. So I'm going to skip through this stuff here and go straight to my final point. This has to do with the interplanetary extension of the Internet. Now, 10 years ago, I brought this subject up and people thought I was either nuts or, you know, smoking something or maybe just, you know, spouting science fiction. And in a way, that's sort of true. It did seem like science fiction then. But in the ensuing 10 years, those of us who've been very interested in supporting both manned and robotic space exploration have been quite focused on Mars because that's one of the more interesting planets in the solar system. We've been using something called the Deep Space Network, which is a system of three 70-meter dishes that are situated around the surface of the Earth in Canberra, Australia, Goldstone, California, and Madrid, Spain. And they communicate with spacecraft that are in orbit around planets or flying past the asteroids or in some cases landing on the surface like the rovers landed on Mars. What's interesting about the Mars program is that the rover in particular landed both of them landed in January of 2004. And the original expectation was that these things would be available for 90 days. They're still operating today, 5 years later. Part of the reason they're still operating is that the solar panels, which we thought would become quite dusty over time and no longer convert power very well, have actually been kept cleaner than we anticipated. You know, I've been speculating that there's somebody up there dusting them off, but we haven't seen them, so that theory hasn't been supported very well. On the other hand, we have seen little dust devils that actually blow the dust off of the solar panels. You can see it from the orbiting satellites. You can see it from the rovers, and that's why they're still functioning. One of them has a broken wheel and has to be driven backwards. You know, there are, you know, infirmities that are showing up in these devices, but they're still delivering data. Speaking of which, the original plan for communicating from the rovers back to Earth was a direct-to-Earth path from the surface of Mars using a 28-kilobit transmission system to the Deep Space Network, the big 70-meter dishes. And they turned those radios on, and they overheated. So they had to reduce the duty cycle. It was already bad enough that it was only running at 28 kilobits a second. The scientists were not too happy that the duty cycle had to be reduced. That meant less data would come back. So the engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory said, well, there is another radio on the spacecraft, on the rovers. It's an X-band radio, and it runs at 128 kilobits a second. It just doesn't have the range that the 28 kilobit radio had. But they said, you know, there are four satellites in orbit around Mars whose original plan was, mission was to essentially observe the surface and then decide where the rovers, or help decide where the rovers would land. But they completed the mapping mission. They were still in orbit. They still had computing. They had power. You know, they had radios. So they reprogrammed the orbiters and the rovers to grab data and transmit it up to the orbiters. And the orbiters would hold the data until they got to the right place in their orbit, and then they transmitted back to the Deep Space Net at 128 kilobits a second, because the orbiters were outside of the atmosphere, they had plenty of power, and they had good radio connectivity. So the result is that the data that's come back from the rovers on Mars is a store and forward application, two hops. Hey, that's how the internet works. It's a store and forward packet switching system. So we had this great example for the scientists that store and forward actually works well. This was, of course, a special purpose implementation. But it worked so well that when we landed the Phoenix lander on the North Pole of Mars in May of last year, they deliberately designed it to run in store and forward mode because there was no configuration that allowed them to transmit directly back to Earth. So the orbiters have now become communication satellites for Mars. And my colleagues and I, even as far back as 1998, thought that it would be really valuable to have a richer networking environment for space exploration than point-to-point radio links. So in a way ahead of the actual implementation of these store and forward special cases, we were working on new protocols for communication in space. We actually started out with a naive belief that we could just use TCP/IP. Well, that lasted an hour and a half. The first thing you can observe is the distance between the planets is literally astronomical. Between Earth and Mars, they're 35 million miles apart when we're closest together in our respective orbits, and when we're farthest apart, it's 235 million miles. Do the math, 3.5 minutes at the speed of light when we're closest together one way, and 20 minutes one way when we're farthest apart, and it just gets worse as you go out to the outer planets. So imagine doing TCP flow control with a 40-minute round-trip time. It doesn't work. Then there's celestial motion. The planets are rotating. We haven't figured out how to stop that. So the result is, if you're talking to something on the surface, the planet rotates, you can't talk to it anymore until it comes back around again. Satellites have the same problem. So we have a delayed and disrupted communications environment, and we develop cleverly named delay and disruption tolerant networking protocols. The DTN protocols are now in test. They're in space qualification testing over about a five-year period. We went through a bunch of iterations, just like TCP. And then we started doing implementation tests. So we have tested the DTN protocols terrestrially using tactical military deployments, and we managed to show that in a highly disrupted environment, we could get 10 to 15 times more data through DTN than we could through TCP/IP. Then we participated in some testing with the reindeer herders up in the northern part of Sweden. And we actually put on the all-terrain vehicles, we put laptops that were running the DTN protocols with Wi-Fi, and we stuck a Wi-Fi server in a village. About 3 years ago, we did that. The all-terrain vehicles kind of wander in like data mules, pick up the data, dump data, and come back around. Then we stuck them on the reindeer, and that worked out pretty well, too. Then we got permission last year from NASA to upload these DTN protocols to a spacecraft called Deep Impact. This was one which a couple of years ago launched a probe into a comet. So this Deep Impact spacecraft is in eccentric orbit around the sun. So it actually goes quite far away, and then it comes close to the sun, and then it goes back out again. So last October, it was on its way back towards Earth. At 81 light seconds away, we uploaded the protocols and tested for a month data going back and forth using the DTN protocols, and it worked. Then we got permission to upload the protocols to some equipment on the International Space Station. So this June, we started testing with the International Space Station. Later this year, probably next month or October, we're going to reload the protocols to that Deep Impact spacecraft, which has been renamed. It's called Epoxy now, and the reason is it's going to go back out to visit another comet. And while it's on its way out to that rendezvous, we're uploading the protocol. So we're going to run a three-node interplanetary internet for test purposes towards the last quarter of this year. When we complete all of those tests, we believe we will have qualified the protocols and their implementations for space application. We will make those protocols available globally. Any spacefaring country that wants to use them is free to use the software. It will be, you know, open source. And we hope, frankly, that if everyone does adopt the use of these protocols for space communication, that all of the spacecraft that are used afterwards will be interoperable in the same way that when you plug into the Internet, you can talk to 600 million machines thanks to a standard set of protocols. So what we expect will happen if everybody adopts this theory is that as each mission gets launched, it becomes, and it completes the mission, if the asset is still available, it will become part of the communications backbone for both manned and robotic space exploration. Now, to come back to IPv4 and IPv6, the DTN system, in fact, does not rely on there being a solar system-wide single IP address space. We actually allow every planet, every satellite, every spacecraft to have its own address space. The DTN protocols actually operate at a higher level. They're up at roughly the same level as the domain name system happens to be. So we're not reliant on a particular version of IP protocol. And we did that on purpose because we figured, first of all, Earth was going to keep consuming address space. We didn't want it to eat all the space that the Martians might need. I don't want the Mars delegation showing up and raising hell in the UN or something. So the other reason is that you don't know, the spacecraft take time to get out there. We're talking years sometimes, even decades. And they aren't necessarily going to be upgradable. And so we want to make sure that the space communication protocols are not bound to too low a level in the communications architecture. So, in fact, we are independent of V4 and V6. We're happy to operate with either one, and that's part of what we've been demonstrating. So let me stop there, and thank you for your time. I'm happy to answer questions, or depending on what the chairman wishes, we go straight into Tony's presentation. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very, very much indeed. Been wonderful, thank you. And